Guardian Unlimited.
I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Now, people often stop me in the street to ask this. They say, Alok, how do you get your hair so luxuriously silky? The answer, my friends, is simple. Take two bottles into the shower, not me. I just pod and go. Coming up on this week's show, we speak to Francis Wells, one of the UK's leading cardiac surgeons, as he prepares to perform a public broadcast of open heart surgery. And as scientists carry out the world's first genome transplant, microbiologist Brian Spratt will help us through the ethics of synthetic biology. Plus, the Egyptians worship them, and stroking them can apparently lower your blood pressure. We'll be finding out more about the DNA paw print of the domestic cat. And there may even be something about man-sized penguins in here too. This is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Howdy to the people of Podland. It's fair to say that we're not in the best shape of our lives here on Science Weekly. Your regular cast has been dropping like flies. Bobby Johnson, James Randerson and Nell Bowes are all off sick and, quote, greener than Shrek. So who is here with me in the pod? Well, they're both back from Glastonbury. They've both got that crazed look in their eyes that comes from not washing for the best part of a week. And talk about nothing else but peace, love and hummus. Yes, it's a double hello to the Guardian Science correspondent Ian Sample and Science Weekly producer Ben Green.
Hello, Alok. Hair looking magnificent as usual.
Couldn't say it better myself.
Now, I've laid down the law to producer Ben about music we were using in today's show. No 80s cheese, no gay disco anthems, though we're not saying there's anything wrong with them. I just want to be a bit more edgy this week. Last week, you'll recall, we went behind the scenes of the Wellcome Collection's new heart exhibition. Well, we're sticking with that theme for a bit because a bit of medical history will be made this week when the UK's first ever public broadcast of an open heart surgery takes place on Thursday. Cardiac surgeon Francis Wells and his team at the Papworth Hospital in Cambridge will perform an operation, and the satellite link will allow an audience of 200 people in London to ask the doctors questions and get an unprecedented view of the human heart. One thing's for sure, it'll be a lot more realistic than ER and casualty. Well, I'm delighted to say that Francis Wells is here with us in the studio. Francis, thank you so much for coming in.
Not at all.
First question, I suppose, is why are you doing it?
Well, I think it's important that people know better what's inside them. Behind your breastbone, an inch away from where you can see, there's this fantastic beating structure which keeps you alive. And I think everybody should understand it better, and perhaps in understanding it better, they will then perhaps treat it better. A few years ago, I was in Chicago with some friends operating out there, and they told me that they were doing live broadcasts to the National Museum of Industry and Science to a lay audience. I thought, what a good idea. And apparently it was always full. It was always full of interested people, and they'd had tremendous feedback on it. We'd never done it in this country, and I thought, why not, at a time when health is so much on the agenda? It's another way to try and broaden people's outlook on their own health.
What do you think the members of the public reaction will be? I mean, are people surprised when they see a heart for the first time?
I think everybody is, including me. I mean, each day you do this surgery, it's quite a phenomenal thing to behold and to be able to partake of. I don't know what they're going to think, and I think that's something I'd like to learn from it. Why they're going, what they want to take from it, what they have taken from it. It would be very nice to learn in about a month's time what they have left with them, as it were. We're looking for ways to try and expand people's understanding of themselves and their own bodies, and through that perhaps improve their attitude towards their own healthcare.
Ian, do you have a question?
Yeah, Francis, can you say something about the sense of responsibility you have when you go in, so to speak, and whether that is something that disappears after so many years of doing this sort of resurgery?
Not at all. I mean, it's absolute. That's the first thing. It is absolute. You're the most important person in that operating theatre room, above all, is the patient at all times, from the moment they enter the arena to the moment they leave. So, no, that's not difficult because, of course, and even more so in the modern world where our results are published in, dare I say, at The Guardian every year, our results are terribly important. But, no, we get to know these people. You meet them in the outpatients. You know them as a human being. You get to know their family. You want to do the best for them. There has to be some slight divorce from that emotionally when you're doing it. Otherwise, I think as one human being with another, you couldn't do perhaps what you always need to do. But no, we're very cognizant of that. And in trying to achieve the best quality at all times for the patient, Education for everybody is absolutely paramount. I mean, medicine is built on a three-cornered stool. It's the clinical work itself, it's the research and teaching, and it all has to go hand in hand. If one leg of the stool isn't quite up to it, you know, it falls apart. So we're brought up on teaching and education from the very start in our medical careers.
I suppose what you're doing, it goes back a bit to the sort of early medicine, I guess. People would watch surgeons, whereas medical students would watch surgeons performing surgery to sort of see what the body looks like inside and so on, and autopsies and that kind of thing. Going back to all of that, I read something about your work studying Leonardo da Vinci's drawings of the heart and how he helped you understand more about the heart yourself. I mean, can you just talk about that a bit?
One of the great sadnesses of today's education, I think, is the separation of the arts and the science. It is actually artificial, if you think about it. We should get back to an integration of the arts and the sciences, and that's one of my passions. And, of course, that was one of the high spots of the Renaissance. I mean, dissections were done usually by artists or in artists' bottegas for their own information in terms of portraying the human body, but also medics would go along and look and learn. In fact, dissection was looked down upon by the physicians, but they did actually go and learn from what they were doing. So there's a tremendous integration of resources that can be brought to bear there. And I think we ignore the arts and all the wonderful things the arts holds in terms of their own intellectual output on life. We miss a tremendous opportunity in trying to expand our way of looking at things. The Leonardo experience you referred to took me, first of all, to the fantastic quality of his drawing. I mean, the way he uses drawing to teach, which is just useful in learning how to teach. But more importantly than that, it makes you look into and draw upon the Renaissance use of logic and rhetoric and humanism. And in doing so, you start to think in a slightly different way. I mean, we're brought up, we're taught what a heart looks like, we're taught what a valve looks like, we're taught what the disease processes are, and we're taught how we should handle them. But as Leonardo says, you know, if you open your eyes, you see new things. If you only do what you're told to do, you never do anything different. And by starting to see the heart as a slightly different structure in a more engineering sense, it allowed me to start to think about the valve and the way it functions in a different way. And so that's what led to a change in my personal practice in mitral valve reconstruction, for example.
What did he show you that, and how did it change what you did?
He did the first experimental work demonstrating how the aortic valve closes. That's the valve that controls the outflow from the left ventricle. And this was extraordinarily ahead of his time. And he did it by comparing some hydrodynamic studies that he was doing. He noticed that whenever water flows from one wide space into another wide space through a narrow space, it always forms vortices. And this is one of the first laws of hydrodynamics that he defined. He also demonstrated that fluid flowing through a pipe, whether horizontally or vertically, always flows faster and further in the center of the pipe than the edge of the pipe. Now, you might think, what's that got to do with it? Well, when you start to think about the actual hydrodynamics of that, and you think of it in the context of how a valve works, you start to think of it in a different way. You don't see a valve as a piece of tissue that just opens and closes. It, at one stage, forms part of yet a boundary surface and a pressurized chamber through which energy is going to be spread equally. So then you say, well, how is that going to happen? And his drawings of the mitral valve, for example, show beautifully the way that energy is dissipated on the underside of the leaflet, just as if you go into King's College Chapel and you look up and you see the stress display in the arrangement of the beams in the roof. I mean, the mitral valve is just the same. So there are common qualities throughout engineering and science that you can bring to apply to the heart. So it's that kind of level of thinking that has impressed me.
Is there anything that man can't do? Well, thanks for all that, Francis. We'll be coming back to you later in the show, and we'll put the details of the broadcast of the open heart surgery on our blog. I'm Alok Jha, and you're listening to Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Still to come, the bad boy of science, Craig Venter, has been at it again. We discuss the ethics of turning one species into another, plus the biggest penguins you'll ever have seen. But first, it's time for a roundup of the other science news that's been making headlines over the past 7 days. This is your News Jam.
News Jam.
NASA plans to build on Einstein's legacy by researching some of the most exotic phenomena in the universe. The Einstein Probes Office was set up last week to coordinate 5 missions to study dark energy and black holes and hunt for clues to the origin and evolution of the universe, areas of physics where Einstein's general theory of relativity has been hugely important.
The ancestry of the world's household cats can be traced to an ancient region of the Near East. A genetic survey of nearly 1,000 domestic cats has revealed that every breed of Moggy alive today originates from just 5 lineages which lived alongside ancient settlers in an area stretching from the Eastern Mediterranean to the Persian Gulf.
And scientists have found a stem cell in mouse embryos that is a near-perfect match for human cells. Mouse cells are used by researchers in models for different diseases, but because mouse and human cells are different, the models are not perfect. The new discovery is good news for research on treatments for incurable diseases such as diabetes and Parkinson's.
And finally, a new perspective on penguins. They may be charming today, but these birds had some fearsome ancestors. New fossils found in Peru reveal that ancient penguins were more than 1.5 metres tall and weighed as much as a person. The 36-million-year-old tropical bird's intimidating appearance was topped off with powerful arms, a chunky neck, and a potentially vicious 18-centimetre beak.
And that was your news jam. Thank you to Ian and Ben. A couple of things I think we can discuss from those stories. Ian, you wrote the cat's story. Tell me a bit more about this fantastic find.
You can just imagine the scene. It started off with a PhD student who was asked to try and understand the genetic differences between a Scottish wildcat and other species up there. The driver was a conservation issue. They wanted to know exactly when they had come across a Scottish wildcat so they would know which ones to help conserve and so on. What happened is that, like sort of PhD projects tend to do, it broadened out to a genetic survey of the entire world's sort of cat population. Obviously, he didn't sequence all of them, but he sequenced sort of certain types from an enormous number of countries. They went around trapping cats in various countries and so on, and they recreated essentially a family tree for cats. And so what they've managed to then find out from that was really interesting. They found that all of the domestic cats that are around in households throughout the world all can be traced back to just 5 lineages, which originated in this fertile crescent in the sort of the Near East Mesopotamia area.
So we all know that the ancient Egyptians were fond of cats. They mummified them and actually deified them and all these things. But so what you're saying is that they and their neighbours thought that's a particularly cute cat, we'll domesticate that, and it spread around the world rather than lots of other places around the world thinking, oh, these animals are quite nice to have in your house.
I mean, certainly you would imagine that these would be domesticated around the world a number of times, but what seems to have happened was a certain group in a reasonably small area, whether intentionally or not, the cats were probably living alongside the humans just to sort of keep, they were just feeding on rodent pests that were raiding their grain stores and things like that, but they became domesticated, and then it seems as if the whole radiation around the globe from there was just because people came along and thought, ah.
Yeah, little lions, exactly. I'm going to move on to the stem cells thing. It's quite a technical achievement, this, in that they found embryonic stem cells from mice, which are more similar to human embryonic stem cells than the one they're using at the moment. They grow in the same sorts of mediums, etc. It's technical and a bit complicated, but important for scientists who are actually researching, as we said, cures for things like Parkinson's and diabetes, because their models will be improved. But Francis, can I ask you, how are stem cells being used to in the sort of study of cardiac diseases? You know, because that's a big killer, and I know that there's lots of research going on. What's the sort of state of play there?
Well, the biggest thrust at the moment is trying to reproduce heart muscle cells, myocytes, that are lost in myocardial infarction. Myocardial infarction, simply the obstruction of the blood flow to a certain area of the heart, muscles then die and are replaced by fibrous tissue. If that area is large enough, then the heart can't function. And people have repeated heart attacks, then will go on and develop heart failure, what's called an ischemic cardiomyopathy. At that stage, the only way out, as it progresses, is transplantation or a bridge transplantation through artificial devices, artificial hearts. So this is, you know, a really big step forwards, with many, many hundreds of thousands of people around the world suffering from this condition. So the nirvana there is to actually recreate myocytes, heart muscle cells, in a form of a grid that you could then implant in the right direction in heart muscles so that they will contract synchronously to produce an output, in other words, drive the blood out of the heart. At the moment, myocytes have been created. Trying to get them on a grid that can be introduced into the heart and that can then turn into what we know as a syncytium, in other words, a group of cells that contracts together to produce the expulsion of blood from the heart, is the next big challenge. That's the sort of engineering technology transfer that has yet to happen. And the other area is trying to reproduce heart valves and so on. As you know, and recently in this country, Professor Yakpoub in his laboratory in Harefield has so far produced a sheet of cells that are the sort that we need to produce valves. The whole point is that the replacement valves that we currently have these days have limitations. Tissue valves in young people fail early. Mechanical valves need lifelong anticoagulation and all the problems that go with that. So if we could find a biological valve that mimics the cells of the individual so it does not trigger an immune response, that is a huge step forward. But once again, the engineering technology transfer is the barrier to process at the moment.
So the engineering, i.e. this idea of actually creating functioning tissue from individual cells which can relatively easily be grown, it seems, is the stumbling block. How far away do you think, any of you guys, how far away do you think we are from sort of useful technologies in that respect? Ian, stem cell correspondent, you can answer that.
I was actually going to ask Francis whether stem cells were actually an interesting prospect in the medium term, I mean, presumably not in the near term, but I was also quite interested in the idea of humanised organs and whether there is any substantial effort looking at sort of humanised pig hearts and things like this, or whether they are just going to be such a rejection issue, whether you can't humanise them properly. Do you know anything about that side?
Well, yes, and in Cambridge we've been quite heavily involved in the so-called Xenograft programme, which is really what you're referring to, and that, for the listeners, is when we create an organ, in this case a heart, that will express human antigen, in other words, human protein, on the surface of the cell, so that when you put that organ into a human, it ameliorates the immune reaction, that you don't recognize it as a foreign animal. The problem with that is that in doing that, you potentially or have the potential to release prion-related diseases, such as bovine spongiform encephalitis, which has been the great topic over the last few years. And at the moment, the microbiologists have not really found a way of controlling that. It's a big worry. So that's the technology is ready to roll. That could be done tomorrow. But until we find a way of being able to predict the outcome of immunosuppressing those cells, which, as you know, in the DNA of the last 10 million years have had all sorts of viruses incorporated into them, which could be released. Until that problem is solved, I think that's not going much further.
Okay, well, we'll leave that there. Thanks to Francis and Ian. People of Podland, please let us know what you think about these topics, especially if you think we've got it wrong, although with a heart surgeon in the pod, I doubt we have. Full details of how to get in touch coming up at the end of the show. Bad to the bone. I broke a thousand hearts before I met you. I break a thousand more, baby, before I am through. It's that man, Craig Venter, again. Barely a week seems to go by without us discussing what this bad boy of science has been getting up to. Well, this time his team have converted an organism into an entirely different species by performing the world's first genome transplant. The work's at the cutting edge of synthetic biology, which is rapidly becoming a controversial area in science. Researchers are currently working on ways to genetically modify human cells, but critics are also concerned that the artificial organisms could escape and damage the environment, or terrorist groups might use the research to create powerful new bioweapons. We'll be speaking with Professor Brian Spratt, who's the chair of molecular microbiology at Imperial College, in just a moment. First, though, this is what Craig Venter himself had to say about why he'd carried out the transplant.
There's two major reasons. With every single genome of hundreds that we've sequenced now, there's a certain percentage of the genes in every genome that are of unknown function. And with the recent data, 6 million new genes that we've just added to the public databases from the Sorcerer II expedition, a very significant portion of those are of unknown function. So having tools to sort out the unknown world by making various combinations of synthetic genomes and understanding what true basic cellular life is, even in one of these tiniest microbial cells, is still a major goal of science that we're a long way from achieving. So on just the basic science levels of understanding life, we think these tools will be essential. As we go into synthetic genomics with some of the goals that we have of trying to see if we could design cells in the future to, for example, manufacture new types of fuel to try and break our dependency on oil and coal and try and do something about the CO2 going into the atmosphere. We hope there's extremely major applications for this.
That was Craig Venter speaking last week from his lab in Rockville, Maryland. Let's speak now with Brian Spratt from Imperial College. Brian, thanks for joining us. Can you take us through quickly what Craig Venter has done?
So far, what he's done is that he's purified the chromosomes from one bacterial species, and he's taken those pure chromosomes and he's managed to get those chromosomes to go into the bacterium of a related species and to kick out the resident chromosome. And so you've got replacement of this sort of recipient bacteria with the chromosome from the other species.
And from a basic science point of view, he said that one of the uses would be to understand the sort of all these mysterious bits of the genome from all sorts of animals that we and plants that we don't really understand what they do. Is his new technique a useful aid there?
I'm a bit surprised he says that, because we can do that in lots of other ways. I mean, I think it's more important to look at what Craig Venter's agenda is, and he's said for several years now that he's going to produce a synthetic bacteria, a designer bacterium. And to do that, you need to do two things. You need to be able to assemble accurately all of the base pairs, all of the building blocks of a bacterial chromosome. And then having built yourself an accurate synthetic chromosome, you then got to put that into a bacterium, kicking out or destroying the resident chromosome. So you've essentially created a synthetic bacterium. So what Craig has done is the second half of that experiment. Now he's got to do the first half, which is to make the synthetic chromosome itself. So I think that's really what he's trying to do.
Well, we'd heard a few weeks ago that he was actually trying to patent some of the processes involved in making a synthetic organism. So that's clearly something that he's aiming to do. But he talks about the creation of these organisms to then do things like suck up CO2 from the atmosphere or to make biofuels. And are these legitimate goals that you can do with organisms like this, or can we do them already with other ways, do you think?
Well, I think, you know, we can find or make bacteria that will do these sorts of things. But the advantage of making a synthetic bacterium that will do that is that you have total design. You don't sort of have to start with, you know, what God gives you. You can actually design it in the way you want. You can get rid of genes that you don't think are necessary, and you can put in all sorts of genes that are necessary and give you great flexibility in synthesizing the organism, which does exactly what you want to do.
And so this field of synthetic biology is incredibly exciting for the reasons you just said. You can make all of this new stuff to exactly the design you want to do the things you want it to do. But there obviously are concerns about maverick scientists or people getting hold of this technology and using it for bad reasons, things like biological weapons. I mean, how seriously do you think we should be taking those concerns?
Well, I think that in terms of people being able to make synthetic or design of bacteria for malevolent purposes is not a concern at the moment, because it hasn't been done yet, and when it is done, it's really sort of state-of-the-art technology. I mean, very, very difficult technology to make a synthetic bacterium. But I think what the concern is that all the interest in synthetic biology is driving the development of better and better ways of making longer and longer pieces of synthetic DNA. And although you can't make a bacterium easily, it's going to become increasingly more easy to make much smaller entities, in particular to make viruses. And I think that's where the concern is, that something which a couple of years ago was really sort of state of the art to make a synthetic virus is going to become easier and easier as the technology develops, and it'll become maybe possible for groups with sort of moderate but not exceptional levels of ability to actually make synthetic viruses. The bacteria is so much bigger that it's a very much more difficult to even contemplate making a synthetic bacterium.
Brian, thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure.
That was Brian Spratt from Imperial College. Ian, I've got a question for you. You covered this story. What are the precautions that synthetic biologists are taking to make sure that this stuff doesn't get into the wrong hands and that they aren't just moving forward without really thinking about the ethics?
Well, there's two things. What are they doing to make sure that this doesn't get into the wrong hands? Well, you have the sort of controls over certain certainly over some of the things these people are creating. I mean, the people who created the 1918 Spanish flu virus is obviously under substantial security, only probably one or two labs, and probably both the US Army labs. But what's really interesting in terms of this information getting out is, as Craig Venter said in his press conference the other day, they're publishing all of this work in the open literature, and everybody else is. Even when the Spanish 1918 flu virus was published, was recreated, so people recreated this from scratch in the lab, the genome was put on GenBank, a free online database. So the information is going out there. You need enormous amounts of expertise at the moment to do things with this, but the people who raise concerns, the most credible people who raise concerns, are, in my view, are the ones who are saying the techniques are out there, people will be able to probably produce some sort of doctored pathogen if they wish to at some point, and that's where the sort of the terrorist worry comes in. There is the ethical side of what happens if these if created new forms of life get out into the environment. Would they be dangerous in the environment? Would they be dangerous to people? And then other people have a lot of ethical issues about the sort of the ownership. Should one be able to patent genes, which are the basic gene sets for life? And these are ongoing questions. And I think the science is going ahead very fast. Not sure the ethics is keeping up.
Didn't Venter actually sort of stop work for a while to sort of try and tackle some of this?
Yeah, in the 90s, they basically put a hold on their work for 18 months, and they got an independent bioethics committee together that looked through all of these issues. They brought together all the major religious organizations and went through all of the details of what they were hoping to do and what the questions were. And according to Venter, at least, and the ethics committee had no problem in what they were trying to do in terms of, you know, playing God. I interviewed one of Venter's now collaborators a long while ago, and he said, I don't see a problem in playing God as long as it's just playing. They're obviously doing this for money. They're private. It's a private. It's a company. They're looking to make money.
Sounds like quite a responsible bad boy then.
He's not. I don't think Craig Venter is a bad boy, but I don't know. I mean,
go on, defend him then.
This is a man who, it's a private enterprise. There are lots of private enterprises who, which do very good science, which progress things very well. They attract very good scientists, and they make a difference. And I think Venter has a bad boy impression because of his coming out and racing the sort of taxpayer-funded effort to sequence the human genome. You know, he's pushing, and he's probably motivated by money, but I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with that. Even though we're on The Guardian.
Francis, I'll give you the last word on this. What do you think of Craig Venter? I mean, he's obviously a very sort of smart, and he's pushing science into very exciting territory. So, you know, does it matter that he's motivated by other things than maybe just knowledge?
No, I think if you look at most of the university departments, they're motivated by money too. It's the next grant, it's the next so on and so forth. So it's just a matter of degree and all the rest of it. No, I think anybody who's got a bright mind is prepared to think laterally and apply that information, as long as he fits into the sort of paradigm you were hearing about in terms of ethics and moral, which is, I quite agree with you, is being left far behind, I think, by the pace of change. I think that's fine, but I don't think every university department in the world is absolutely, pristine in that area either.
Well, maybe not so bad then for the bad boy of science. Thanks a lot, guys.
My name is Tony Blair, and I think the Guardian Science Podcast is a great idea.
I thought we'd left that behind a long time ago. Thank you, as always, for all your comments and emails over the past 7 days, especially Naomi Fern, who calls us the chirpy cheerleaders of science. We're about to hit the 300 mark with our Facebook network, and there is actually one truly mesmerising discussion going on there right now about the mechanics of fossilisation. Perhaps, though, we can start another one. Laurie in Coventry writes,
what is the worst-case scenario if the Large Hadron Collider at CERN creates a black hole? Should I take out some new insurance in case it's devouring the Earth?
It's definitely one to consider, and we'll get our CERN correspondent, Brian Cox, onto that. Talking of CERN, we'll have more from Brian in the next few weeks. A special mention, though, has to go to our token Canadian listener, Kian Kintz-Wu. By the time you hear this, it might be a bit late, but happy Canada Day. Remember, we're taking requests for honorary token memberships of our network, so get in quick. Ian, do you want to say something about the Large Hadron Collider before we... You had something to say, didn't you?
Well, it was just quite interesting, because the idea of a small black hole being generated at the Large Hadron Collider was actually an issue that came up at one of the US colliders and was referred to very sort of dismissively in a letter to Scientific American a long while back. And the sort of the real horror happened when guy called Frank Wilczek at MIT wrote into Scientific American to say, well, actually, a small black hole isn't the problem. You want to worry about the creation of these things called strangelets, which we probably don't need to go into right now, because they might really cause problems. And this whole
You've just skipped
fuss,
over that.
This whole fuss kicked up over these things, which required both of these labs to do their own analyses to find out whether their enormous apparatus and equipment was going to produce something that would destroy maybe not even Earth, but the universe. And I've read at least the LHC report on this, and it's mind-boggling, but it's fascinating stuff. But the idea of what you can do about it. Incidentally, the black holes will decay by Hawking radiation, as I'm sure our readers know.
I'm not even going to ask you how you know all that. I'll tell you what, I love the way we're very, very sort of cavalierly skipping over the destruction of the universe. On a more positive note, we've still got our guest, Francis Wells, here. And I want to ask you, Francis, before we finish, just a couple more things. I'm curious, what does the heart look like when you see it? I mean, we all imagine it's this nice red beating thing, but is it different to that?
No. Well, it's slightly triangular in shape. It's all the wrong way round, and what we call the right ventricle's on the front, the left ventricle's on the back. It has the two main arteries leaving it, the aorta and the pulmonary artery, and the two main veins draining into it, the inferior vena cava and the superior vena cava, and the veins that drain from the lung you can't see because they're right around the back, the superior and inferior pulmonary veins, right and left. It has fat, which follows the coronary arteries, which varies in different people, but the muscle is sort of pinky browny red colour. But the point you raise about colour is actually something that I think will blow people away. I've had several artists in residence with me over the years, and the first thing they say when they see the heart is the colour is absolutely beautiful and it's staggering. I was in the Sagrada Familia just a couple of days ago, where Gaudi's started to build this wonderful cathedral. He said he wanted colour everywhere because colour represents life. Without life, there's no colour. And I think you'll see that in a wonderful way. And it's one of the spin-offs I hope we might get out of this. And I was talking about art-science collide. And I think here, you know, just the sheer beauty of the thing, the way it works, the fact it has to work for you to survive, the way it's made, the colour of it. I mean, it is just the most extraordinary organ.
I've got a really silly final question, actually, after that eloquent description of the heart. I feel this is very silly, but I want to ask you, who chooses the music when you do heart surgeries?
Me.
what's going to be your music for next week?
You'll have to wait and see.
All right. Well, that's it for this week. If you want to comment on anything we've discussed in the show, head to the blog, MySpace, or the much-mentioned Facebook network. The blog, incidentally, is about to get a much-needed makeover, so stay tuned. Don't forget that our full podcast archive is there for your oral pleasure at guardian.co.uk/science/podcasts. The magnificent Johnny Berlino will be here in the pod next week, and you wouldn't want to miss that, would you? But for now, my thanks to Ian Sample and our special guest, Francis Wells. I'm sure I'm not alone in wishing you a steady hand for Thursday. Science Weekly has been produced by Ben Green. I've been Alok Jha, and I've lived to tell the tale.
Guardian Unlimited.